Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Jude Kingshott. Jude, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much.
All right. Every time someone is described as a textile artist or mixed media artist, I sit up and pay attention because invariably we get to go down fun paths of art and creativity that we just don't normally see in just standard needlework. And yeah, you're fun. You're fun.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. So this, I watched the video. Okay, so we're dyeing things. We're making books. We're
eco printing.
All of it. All right. So we got to get some focus here. Focus.
Yes.
I watched the video where you showed how to eco print with the leaves and putting it between those metal roofing plates. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes.
And then putting in a pot of boiling water. Holy smokes.
So this was the video that I made for Festival of Quilts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So then, that's another question I have. What is Festival of Quilts? Because you've made it quite clear you're not a quilter, but.
Well, Festival of Quilts is a quilt show which is held in Birmingham every year. And they have masterclasses, some prior to the show opening. But to say it's a quilting show is quite a large umbrella. There's a lot under the umbrella. And I was involved through Committed to Cloth. They have it's called a virtual studio, but it's not virtual. I think they've changed the name now to the Creative Studio. So we had a studio there where students showed off what they could do to encourage people to let everybody see this is what you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody can do this. And prior to that, I teamed up with it's quite a complicated story. I'll try and make it short.
We got all day, Jude.
with a German mixed media artist who I learnt eco printing from. And we have been working together collaboratively for about 4 or 5 years. And her and I taught eco printing and bookmaking, sometimes eco printing with indigo dyeing, prior to the show as a masterclass. And the reason the video got made was because of COVID, everything got cancelled.
Yeah.
Brunhilde couldn't come, so they asked me if I'd make a video. So that's how it came about.
COVID just permeates everything. I'm sick of it.
I know, I'm sick of it. And just when you think things are getting better, no, it rears its head again.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Terrible stuff. Yeah. Terrible
yes.
stuff.
So the eco printing and the bookmaking seem to be tied at the hip. Is it eco printing to make the books, or is it how does that work? Because those things are beautiful.
Yes, but I have always made books of one form or another, whether they're artist books, but I've made books. And a few years ago, I decided that I would learn to make books properly. So I did a proper bookmaking course, which actually it's like a lot of things. You can go along and you can get what you want. But if you go and do a course with somebody who knows how to do it properly, then you can dot the I's. And that's how it was for me. I know that some of the books I made in the bookmaking course I'll never make again because they were just quite rigid for me.
Mm-hmm.
But things like cutting paper, you know, it sounds so simple, but it isn't actually.
Yeah.
It's people try hard, but they find it hard to cut it straight. And there is a skill to it. So after my bookmaking course and I began eco printing, it became clear that these things could be pulled together. And that's how that came about.
So when you said you were making, you've been making books for a while, were you making like fabric books, or were you making books for keeping your notes in, like art journals?
Oh, no, I never make books to keep. I never make books for me, actually. The books that I would make would be, I did a lot of one page books. I did a lot of concertina books, because I've used books as a way of collage and stitching. I would do them that way because I love stitching on paper. So those are the sort of books I would make.
Okay. So that now raises a question, because I got the impression that generally the books you were making were for, like Beth suggested, note-taking or storing little keepsake pictures and that kind of thing in. So these are more of just an art form then.
Yes, and they would be motivated by, I did a trip to Japan with a friend and I collected lots of papers, you know, lots of all sorts of bits of paper, and I made a series of books from these papers. I collaged them, I stitched them, and they were, so I would do that. But I also make books for other people to use with plain pages. You know, I cover right across.
Okay. Because my impression, as I looked at the photos of the books you make, is there isn't a chance I'd put any writing on those whatsoever.
No. And the pictures that I sent you one, which is a book that I've made completely of, during COVID, of leaves that were in my garden. And then I made a book out of those. And I think I sent you, sometimes I cross over into origami.
Yes.
And I will, yes. So I think I sent you a picture of, it's a sphere. And that is made from an old German book and other papers that I found. So I make those a lot. So I do, I'm a little bit of a butterfly when it comes to books. And every time I think, oh, right, okay, I'm settled, then I'll see something else that I think, oh, that motivates me to make something in, you know, in that sort of form. But anything to do with paper, I'm in. I love paper. I love fabric too, but at the moment I'm having a passionate affair with paper.
Now, okay, the butterfly of books. That's what I'm putting down here, the butterfly of books.
Oh, okay. That sounds nice, doesn't it?
We're going with that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, this all started, you've traveled quite a bit, but this all started in Egypt with with a group of expatriate American ladies.
Yes, I grew up, the house that I grew up, my father made things, my mother did a lot of practical things, she knitted, she sewed, she did loads of things, so I always had it in me, and I can't remember when I didn't make something. But in the 70s, in my peer group, it wasn't very fashionable. It was a little bit sneered at if you made things. So I think I played it down quite a lot. But then in the mid-70s, I went to live in Egypt with my husband, who was working out there. And I met these American ladies who were working for an oil company, I think. And they were making a quilt as a wedding present. So they had this quilting bee and they had this quilt on a frame in this big room. And I was absolutely mesmerized. You know, I just thought, wow, I liked the fact that they were making it together. I loved the fact that it was going to be a wedding present. Everything about it excited me. And one of the ladies lent me a book. And it was, I think it was quite a basic, and I thought, right, that's it, I'm making a quilt. So I made a quilt, but I couldn't get any wadding because they didn't have any in Egypt. I think the American ladies got theirs sent over. So it ended up being a duvet cover.
Yeah.
But I stitched it by hand because I didn't have a sewing machine. So I never actually got to quilt it. But then I went from there and I made a quilt for my firstborn child and my secondborn child. And I made quite a few quilts, but I would never call myself a quilter because they were always a little bit hit and miss, shall we say. I think perfectionists would probably think, oh, my goodness.
Are you saying your points don't line up?
Probably, yes. And the other thing was I never wanted to machine quilt. I did a course on how to do it, but it never really grabbed me. So any quilt that I made, I always quilted by hand. And we always come back to, there's something in my hands that say, you need to stitch this. You need to hand stitch. So I think I've made quilts over the period of time. And the last quilt I made was a very small quilt for my last grandchild, who is now 4. Mm-hmm. And I always used the same pattern. It was the pattern that I used for my son. And I've probably made, well, I don't know, 40 of these quilts. And I'm so fed up with making them. I hope my children don't have any more children because I don't want to make any more of them. You know, they love them, but that's just not me. No, I just think, oh, no. So now I don't really make quilts.
The first grandma ever to say, I hope my kids don't have more kids.
Yes, I have 4. That's enough. That's enough quilts. And of course, the other thing that happened was when I went to work with Leslie Morgan, who is a quilter, although she says she's an embroiderer who makes quilts, and I was the studio manager at Committed to Cloth. Most people were making fabric for quilts when I first started there. So they just assumed, well, I must be a quilter. And this is where this phrase came from, because I would say, I'm not a quilter. And they would all think it was so funny if I was ever making a quilt for one of my grandchildren. I thought you said you weren't a quilter. So that's why I say I'm not a quilter, because I'm not a quilter.
Well, and it's funny to me that you made, you think about 40 of the same pattern. I can see why you don't want to do the same pattern again.
Yes, that would and feel I think it was, I made it for my son had a daughter, and I thought, oh, I'll make the same quilt, and that's how it started. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd made them for friends, but then my children both said, oh, can we have the same quilts? Yes, okay.
Yes. She grits her teeth and sits down and starts sewing.
Yes.
But now, okay, you don't quilt, but I get a sense that in the work that you do, the paperwork, the dyeing, the embroidering of these paper pieces, do I get the correct sense that the quilting has had an influence, that it plays a role in your thinking, or is that just something that is on the side?
I think the quilting was a creative outlet. Mm-hmm. But I've always embroidered in one way or another. I mean, in the early 70s, of course, it was very fashionable to embroider Levi's.
Yes.
So I do remember I did that. I wish I'd kept them now. I probably couldn't get into them, but I wish I'd kept them.
I have a pair of those. I wish I kept mine too. I wish I'd kept mine because there's no way I'd fit them.
No, that's the problem. So I've always hand stitched whatever. Even if I'm working on something else, I've still got some hand stitching. I've always got a piece of work that I've got on the go that I can pick up and put down, because it's a bit like breathing. I know that sounds quite extreme, but it is. I have to do it. Does that sound bizarre?
No, because no. Beth will tell you the same story. Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm glad I'm not the only person.
No, you're quite normal. You're quite normal.
Right. Yeah.
Good. If I
don't stitch in the day, you know, maybe it's been a busy day. I'm like, okay, then tomorrow I must. And if a week goes by, that's way too long. You know, I really need to pick up a needle and thread, and you know, do something.
So today I've been in my studio and I've been making books all day, but I have in the house, when I go into the house this evening, I have something that Brunhilde and I are working on together, which is hand stitching. So every day, for me, it's every day. Every day I have to stitch something. And sometimes if I go out, like if I'm on the train, or I'll have to take it with me. I have to do it. There's just something about it.
It's okay. Right. Beth's husband has told her, leave the room and go stitch. So,
right.
Yeah, you're fine. You're fine.
Good, yeah. good. Yeah. Yes.
Now, are you one of those where no matter what it is you do, it comes out of your head as opposed to getting someone else's design and simply executing it?
It comes out of my head.
Yeah, okay.
I think that I would find it quite hard to follow someone else's design. And I think if I've ever tried to do that, what happens is my hands suddenly go, no, we're going to stitch this way. and then I start stitching some other way. It that's just how it is for me. You know, and I'm never stuck for ideas. That's the other thing. I'm never stuck for ideas. Yeah. Which is fantastic for me.
Well, it's that we've talked to several people who are like that. You artists that it's just falling out of your head all the time is just something I really struggle to relate to. It must at times must be I can't get things down fast enough. I can't get them executed fast enough because I got 10 ideas coming behind that. It must even get frustrating at times.
I don't know what other people do, because we all get periods of time where we don't know which way we're going. You know, for me, that's a good thing, because, you know, at the end of it, you'll probably get something new. But for me, when I get to those periods, I will just do something, do a process. I'll eco print or I'll make a book. I'll just do something to keep the juices going until the ideas come in. And as you say, once one idea comes in, then you start getting these what ifs. Oh, what if I did that? And what if I did something else? And you're away. it's just raining it all back sometimes.
So you're saying, like, when you like you're kind of hit a dry spell, like you're not really feeling very creative, you go and do a batch of eco printing.
Yes.
And then when that eco printing comes out, then what?
Then that will, I'll look at it and think, oh, now I know what I'm going to do with this. Because at the start of COVID, I was a little bit panicky, I think, like a lot of people, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do, the teaching, it's traveling. And suddenly we couldn't do any of that. And it was like, oh, what am I going to do? You know, sitting here with all this time, which we all yearn for, but when we have it, are a little bit, overwhelmed by it. So that's when I thought, okay, I'm going to eco print with all the leaves in my garden just to see what I get out of it. Because a lot of them I'd never even tried.
Hmm.
So you know, and that led on to other things and I haven't looked back since. You know, I've got loads of ideas and loads of things that are going on in my head.
So as awful as it's been globally, the pandemic artistically for you has been an excellent period to really grow.
Yes, and because of the internet, of course, I'm still able to work with Brunhilde in Germany. Because we can FaceTime each other and, you know, throw ideas out to each other. And with some of my other friends, FaceTime has been a real lifesaver because we can keep in contact and still work together, even though we're not in the same room.
Yes, that's been the one good thing about the pandemic. It's opened up that possibility of that collaboration with other people that maybe you could, like, I would meet with a group of friends once a month, but we were able during the pandemic, during the height of it, we were meeting once a week just to talk and to share.
Yes.
That's and so helpful.
And support each other, because I'm mm-hmm. sure everybody's struggling with the same things that we all are.
Right.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Tell about the Committed to Cloth studio. That seems to have been it seems to be something I want to know more about. So
okay, so I don't know. Do you know anything about the Committed to Cloth studio?
No, not a thing.
Okay, so
that's why we called you.
have you heard of Claire Benn?
Yes, that name rings a bell.
Okay, Claire Benn and Leslie Morgan. Leslie Morgan is from California, but has lived in the UK for many years. They met on a Nancy Crowe course and then collaborated together, and they started this studio called Committed to Cloth. And they wrote quite a lot of books, and for a long, long time in the UK, it was the go-to place because there were very few studios that were teaching wet work, you know, all aspects of it. And I went there as a student because I used to work a lot with Procyon Dyes. I haven't worked with them for quite a while now. But then Claire decided that she wanted to pursue her own artistic studio. And so another premises was made for Leslie, and she asked me if I'd be the studio manager.
Mm.
You know, which... lucky me. It was absolutely fantastic. And I did it for 6 years, and it entailed doing anything that Leslie wanted me to do. I supported a lot of outside tutors who came in. Like, we had Sandra Brownlee. That was fantastic. We had Matthew Harris. You know, we had so many really good tutors who came and taught. I taught there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's closed.
Oh.
It closed this year.
Oh.
So I'm afraid. But now there are plenty of other places in the UK that have sprung up, and most of them are ex-students of Committed to Cloth.
Oh.
So they have played quite a big part in the development of that industry in the UK.
Yeah.
But I will be forever grateful for being given the opportunity. It was absolutely fantastic. It was jolly hard work, but it was, you know, really good for me.
Jolly hard work, but if you love it, who cares? Yeah.
Who cares? Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So when you say wet work, you're talking about surface design on fabric mainly? Is that what you all were doing then?
So we would do, they did a course called Wet and Wild, which gave you an insight into lots of different processes, from families of dyes to breakdown printing to discharge, you know, you name it. I'm trying to think of some of the other, but it was mainly surface design. And then as the studio grew, then we started branching out, and we had other people. Like, we had somebody come and do collagraph plates. Somebody came and did lino cut. So there was a lot of stuff that came out of that studio. But I think initially it was about fabric, mainly about fabric.
Okay, and I have to ask, what is breakdown printing? That was
I think you know it as something else. I think you know it. It's very similar to deconstructed screens.
Okay.
I think somebody called Joy Stockwell did it in the 70s. And it basically, it's putting the thickened protein dye onto a screen, letting it dry, and then you put a paste or another dye, another protein dye, and the screen breaks down. Mm-hmm. And then you get these fractured images about, I don't know, 10, no, probably not that long, 8 or 9. It was everywhere. It was the go-to thing. Everybody wanted to do it because it was so different. And I've done quite a lot of it on paper. Because, of course, we come back to paper.
I was going to say, because she loves paper.
Because I love paper. And it is. But I think in the States it is called deconstructed screens.
I've heard that term. Okay.
And I think somebody called Kerr Grabowski, she does a lot of breakdown screens.
Yep. That name. Right. I was just curious because it was like one of those terms that I was like, I don't recognize it. Now I do. Now I know exactly what you're talking about.
And what do you know it as?
The deconstructed.
Yes.
And we played with it. We didn't have screens to use, but we kind of we were doing it with like potato starch, doing it like as a resist.
Oh, yes. So we call them flour paste screens, where you put the flour paste on and you scratch into it.
Right. And then
you put your dye through it. But this is something a little bit different to that. It is about breaking down the screen and the fragmented image that you get from as the screen breaks down. Because you've already got color on the screen. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think I've seen the technique in the Art Quilting magazine.
Yes. I don't think it's so popular now because these things are popular and then get pushed aside for something else, don't they?
Right. Yes. Always. And I always say something new is popping up, you know, like right now eco printing is very popular.
Yes. Eco printing at the moment is the thing to do, isn't it? But some of us have been doing it for a very long time. But I think once it comes into the media, you know, and particularly on social media, then you start to see it everywhere.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of eco printing out there.
How did you encounter eco printing? And give for people who have no idea what we're talking about, give a little rundown of what eco printing is.
Okay, I'll try. My introduction to eco printing, again, I'd fiddled about. Once upon a time, you could get an image off of a leaf by hammering it, and it sounds as brutal as it was. So I did that a little bit, but then you see.
Wait a minute. You can't just blow by that.
Have you not done hammered leaves?
No. You got to tell about that now. We can't just do that.
Okay, so if we go back, I'm going back now to the early 90s, and this was a way of getting an image from a plant. I think I used rosemary. What else? Sunflowers. So what you did was you had soda-soaked fabric, so white soda-soaked fabric. Then you got whatever plant material you wanted to use, and you put it underneath a piece of like kitchen paper, absorbent paper, and then you beat hell out of it. So you hit it really hard with a hammer, and of course it released its color, and you were left with an image. I mean, it wasn't terribly satisfactory, and I never really liked beating the plant, but it was a way of getting something onto the fabric. And if I remember rightly, you couldn't wash the fabric. That was the other problem with it. So you had this lovely image, but you couldn't wash the fabric. So then fast forward, see, it wasn't terribly exciting.
But I can think of many days when beating the hell out of a plant with a hammer would be very satisfying.
Probably. So if we fast forward, Leslie used to go to Germany to teach in this studio in Germany, which is owned by a lady called Brunhilde Scheidmeier, and she came to the UK to teach, and that's how I met Brunhilde, and that's who I learned my eco printing from, because Brunhilde's been doing it for many, many years, but she's kept it very quiet. I think she taught it in Germany, but she didn't really, you know, she's a bit like me, not a lot to do with social media, so it wasn't really out there.
Yeah.
Anyway, she came and I learned it from her. And prior to that, I'd had a little dabble with natural dyes. I'd done some work with natural indigo, but I didn't really know much about eco printing. But I have to say, the first time I did it, I thought, oh my God, this is so fantastic. Look at this. Look at what you get from these lovely leaves and these flowers. And that was it. You know, it's a bit like the quilting moment. That was it. I thought, yes, that's for me. And it went on from there. So the process I use is where it's about contact, because you have to have good contact. And I use mordants and tannins, which encourage the color to come out of the leaf or the flower. I use mainly leaves. So, and the way I get the pressure is to put it between these plates, which are called roofing plates because they use them to build roofs. And they're plates with holes in. And then you clip them together with just clips. And then you boil them in, I usually boil mine in logwood, which is a beautiful blue. And you boil them for 45 minutes and you take it out, try and wait so you don't burn your hands. Mm-hmm. And then you open them up and there you go. You've got these, you know, lovely, and depending on the mordant that you use, depends on the color that you get.
Okay, dumb guy question here. All right, when I watched the video, you had two substances that you brushed onto the leaves. Those the mordants?
Those are the mordants. One was copper and one was iron.
Okay.
And the copper tends to give you the yellowy colors, sometimes greeny colors if it mixes with that, depending on what leaf. And the iron is something that you have to be careful with it because it's quite dark. So you can totally obliterate everything else if you put too much iron on.
Yeah, because you were really careful how much you brushed on.
Yes, and I learned that from my friend because she would say, not too much, because I think it's something that when we begin, oh, yes, I'll put lots on. And, of course, then you get this really dark image, which is nice, but you lose the detail. So yes, you have to be quite gentle with it. And it's a bit like everything that you do. The more you do it, the more familiar you get with it, the better it is, because you just need to understand it to get the best out of it.
Yeah. So you have an element of artistic control with these mordants and then what you boil it in. You're not just at the mercy of nature then.
No. The artistic element comes in how you place the leaves, what type of leaves you use, and what you put it, you know, because you don't have to use logwood. I like blue, so I tend to use logwood a lot. But you can just not use anything. And then if you just boil it in water, you just get the images without this blue around the outside. that you get if you use logwood. You can use madder. You can use other things to boil it in. And some people steam it, but I boil it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So yes. this actually almost becomes a mad chemist shop in terms of you can just try all kinds of things then.
Well, Brynhilde's always encouraged me, if you want to try it, try it. And the worst thing that happens is you don't get a very good image. But sometimes if you use it and you don't get an image, it'll act as a resist, which gives another element to it, because you won't have the leaf, but you'll have the outside of the leaf. So it does have a lot of potential, but I really do believe you have to work at it. You can't just pick it up and say, oh, I'm going to do this. You need to understand what's going on a little bit.
It's one of those things, don't you think you have to play with it? I mean, I tried it one time and I didn't have a lot of success. And I know that part of that is I only did it one time.
Yes. And I think that sometimes people do expect to get this great result immediately. But I think it's like anything. You have to work at it. It just gets better. It's the same with indigo dye. You know, I think there's a mystique about it, which isn't necessary. But I think you have to work at it. You can't expect to get the same result as somebody who's been doing it for a long time. But I think people find that quite hard to grasp, or don't want to, because they just see what's being done and think, oh, I want some of that. But you have to work at it.
Yeah, it's more the don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Instant gratification, yes.
And I sound like I'm, you know, going on a little bit, but I find it frustrating sometimes when, particularly if you're teaching, when people say, oh, it doesn't look like yours. Well, no, because I've been doing it for X number of years. And if you just stop and try not to achieve that, but be happy with what you've achieved, and then the next time your results will be even better. So that's my rant for the day. I'm not ranting anymore.
Well, that's all fine. I think sometimes we don't play. We don't want to take the time to say, how do my materials work?
Yes.
And experiment with them. And like Gary just said, instant gratification. And
yes. Also, I think it's about accepting that sometimes things don't work and sometimes we fail. And I think sometimes we learn more from the failures than we do from the successes.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There is nothing wrong with failing. Absolutely nothing.
Yep. Have to be willing to try that. So, and that's interesting that you say that about indigo dyeing, because I relate to you immediately, because blue is by far my favorite color. So when I looked at your stuff, it's like, oh boy, spot on. But yeah, I've read about people who indigo dye, and I've always had the impression that to do it successfully is very difficult. But you would not subscribe to that.
No, I wouldn't. I would say if you can let go of, oh, indigo, it's really difficult. It isn't really difficult. You just need to be patient, and you need to accept that sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you get failures. But if you stick with it, even if you bought a kit and you followed the instructions, if you stick with it, if it fails, never mind. Try again. I mean, I've had made vats and they haven't worked, but it doesn't put me off, because, you know, I know what you can get out of it. And if you go somewhere like India or China, they don't get all, oh, you know, they just get on with it. they don't treat it like it's something mysterious. They just do it. And that's, you know, I had a lot of failures, but I wanted to get the results. So I stuck with it. And I think indigo is just magical. It's really lovely. When you take that piece of cloth out and it's green, and you know, you think, oh, it's green, and then it turns this beautiful blue. And the more you put it in, the bluer it becomes. It's just so clever.
Yeah, you get some beautiful blues, I'll tell you that. It's really nice.
Yes.
Really
yes.
Nice.
It is lovely, yes. And I like things to be very dark. I think I sent you some pictures,
yes.
A picture of a piece. It's a circle, and underneath it has dye, and then I've stitch-resisted and put it into the indigo probably, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 times to get that depth of blue.
Wow.
Mm.
But you see, again, if you're teaching stitch resist, people want to put it in, take it out, let it oxidize for 5 minutes and then undo the stitching. but of course, you need to wait. You
right.
need to wait. Just be patient.
Impatient Westerners. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So have you done any indigo, either of you?
I have not done indigo. I have a friend, actually, she grew indigo leaves.
Ooh, and, nice.
And was gathering them. And she didn't have a great result. And she did end up pounding when Gary was talking, you guys were talking about pounding the leaves. I think she pounded some of those leaves because she didn't have enough to make a vat of dye. So she did what she could with them. And she's been playing with them ever since, you know, trying to get a little bit bigger crop. And
right. I have to say I've never actually grown any. I don't even know if they'd grow in the UK. I don't know what climate they need.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what she found and how, because I live in the Midwest, and I was surprised she could grow it here, but she did. She was getting some, but I don't know if she had quite has enough to do.
Because of course they grow them in India and China, and it's much hotter there. And I don't know if you've ever seen how they do it in India.
No.
Oh, it's fantastic. I don't know if you know the company Maiwa. They're a Canadian company, and they have got this fantastic video about indigo, and it takes you through the process in India where they harvest it. And of course, it's the men that do most of the work, and they pound it, and it's really fascinating to watch. But again, it's quite... it's not sophisticated, but there is a sophistication about the process because it's been passed down all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really worth looking at, because then you see where it comes from and how it gets to where it is. It's very good.
These processes just amaze me because they were developed so long ago. Because today all the knowledge we have of chemistry and interactions and things, and somebody figured that out long ago without 8 years of college education. And, you know, it's just amazing. And, you know, and something that then not only did they figure out, but then here we are today using essentially the same processes to get the same thing. And,
But don't you think it's true that nothing in art is new?
No, right.
So we're all just working on things that go way, way, way back. We just tweak them and change them a little bit. I have to say, sometimes not always for the better, but but we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that can be said. All right, so now we've got eco printing, we've got dyeing, all these things, but then you take it to a new level. Another level with your embroidery work, like you described earlier, your hands just have to do things. Is there a you know, especially with paper, embroidery with paper, a thread, a type that you use, like a thin, a thick?
I like to use a very small needle. You can buy quilting needles, very small quilting needles with big eyes. that's my favorite needle. Everybody always laughs at me because I have this really small needle, but I really love the feel of it. And over the years, the thread that I use has got thinner and thinner and thinner. And I really like it as thin as I can possibly get it, because the way I stitch, where I layer it up now, you can do this and build up the color and the texture much easier than you can with, for me, it works for me with thicker threads. But I know other people achieve wonderful results with thicker threads. But for me, the thinner the thread, the better it is. And it's the same with paper. I will always opt for a thinner thread with a small needle.
And dye your own threads to coordinate with the artwork that you're creating, or?
That is a recent thing. A recent thing that just started doing. I have dyed threads in the 90s. It was fashionable to do multicolored threads where you put them in. That was the last time, and that was using protein dyes. But now, again, because I'm working in collaboration with Brunhilde, we have been dyeing threads to match the fabric that goes underneath is the basis before the indigo goes. And at the moment, I'm working on a series using vintage handkerchiefs, which have been naturally dyed and are going to be stitch resisted and then hand embroidered. And I have to say, I've just had one accepted for a gallery in London, so I'm really excited about that. One piece of work, which is I'm very excited about, for an exhibition that's coming out in February. And that's heavily embroidered.
The exhibitions, is that you do a lot of that as a way of sharing your art?
Yes, I have done quite a lot of exhibiting. This year I exhibited in Germany, and that was an exhibition that had been put off because of COVID. That went really well. It was very nice. The place where it was exhibited was much smaller than it normally is. It was a textile show, and the whole thing had been pared down, but it was still very nice. It was very nice to be out amongst people and very nice to be sharing my work.
Yeah.
That
has to be incredibly gratifying to create art and be able to exhibit it, but even more so to have people come see it and to talk to them about it.
Yes. And it's really nice when people are interested in your work and ask you about it, you know, and say nice things about it. And I can still remember the feeling when somebody bought a piece of the first time I ever sold a piece of work, I was just, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe that somebody wanted to buy something that I had made. It was absolutely fantastic. You know, it's such a compliment when somebody wants a piece of your work in their house. It's really lovely. But that's not the predominant reason for creating. You know, it just isn't. It's just a very nice extra if somebody buys something.
Is there a series of emotions that goes through selling a piece that you've created? You're giving up part of you.
If I put something in an exhibition, then I'm happy to sell it.
Okay.
If I've made something that I become particularly attached to, then no, I probably wouldn't ever bother to show it. I'd just keep it. And wouldn't sell it, wouldn't even think about selling it. Because you can bet your life, if you put something up, somebody will want to buy it when you don't want to sell it. Right. So for me, it's easier to just, I know I've seen people put not for sale, but that seems to make people want to buy even more.
Right, yeah, that's almost cruel, yeah.
Yes. It's, oh, I want a really... And I have been asked in the past to make another piece when a piece has been sold, and I can't do that either. I absolutely am not able to do that.
Yeah,
I tried it once, yeah. And
yeah,
it
I wouldn't
didn't
think,
work.
Yeah, with the kind of work you do, I wouldn't think you could just be a factory, no.
No, I just, I did a collage that had some stitching, and somebody wanted three pieces for a specific purpose, and I spent weeks and weeks and weeks, and I just couldn't do it. And in the end, I cut the original piece up into three pieces because I felt really guilty because she wanted it for this reason, and she was very happy. But I realized then, if somebody asked me, I just couldn't do that. It is what it is, and that's it. And then, you know, the next piece will be slightly different.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
See, and I've wondered that because now if you look at it, you know, I sold it, and then people start saying, oh, you can make money doing this. Well, but that's not the goal. But,
no.
But then when it comes to commission work, that must be – I have a sense then that you just have no interest because now you're being forced to create some art.
Yes, I would find it. I think I just made the decision after that no, I wouldn't take commissions because I just think I would find it stifling in a way. It's a bit like I've been in a couple of groups and one of them worked to a theme, and I just found it really, really difficult, and I could not get my head past. Oh, it's got to be about this.
Yeah.
And I realized that's not how I work. I did make a piece of work, but I wasn't really happy with it. And it went in the exhibition and I thought, this is just not for me. I'm just not a theme person. You know, I think some people do work really well to themes.
Yeah.
So you don't like those sort of constraints. When you're doing art, you don't. Like I have friends who they like working to a theme and it helps them. It gets their creative juices flowing. But for you, that like dries up the well.
No, it doesn't work for me. And I think that I can see why if you're part of a group, having a theme really keeps everything together and everybody's, you know, singing from the same sheet. They each produce a different type of work. But it is. It's like you've put a blindfold on me, and I just can't. I think, ooh, I don't know. You know, it doesn't do anything for me. So it just doesn't work for me.
I could hear in your voice, even talking about it, you just hit this wall of frustration.
It's just, no, don't give me a theme. And sometimes I don't understand. I didn't understand the theme. I sort of... The way that the decision was arrived at was a little bit, okay, right, fine. I don't really get it. So, you know, I think I can work with another person because, you know, we've grown together. But I think as part of a group, it was a great group, but it just didn't work for me. I tried two groups and neither of them really worked for me. I'm sure they found me very difficult, but I tried to behave.
Well, credit for that. You know.
Yes. A little credit there. Yeah. Okay, I have another question for you. When you do hand stitching, is that the last layer you put on? Or you said something, you were doing a stitching resist, like that's shibori.
Yes. So stitch resist is not the same as hand stitching. It is obviously you stitch with your hands, but stitch resist is to form a barrier to stop the indigo from going through the fabric.
Right, and then you remove that, and then you add another layer.
When you've got the outside color that you want, then you remove the stitching. And then you end up with the thing in the middle or wherever it is. And then that's the hand stitching. That's where the hand stitching comes in.
I just wanted to make sure we clarified that to our listeners, because some of them don't do the sort of resist dyeing. And that is such a fun technique.
It is. It is a really nice technique. And I think it's a technique that most people can do, because you don't have to be a fantastic stitcher. All you have to do is be able to do running stitch. And mm-hmm. I think most of us can do that.
Yes.
So, yeah. But the hand stitching, well, the embroidery, if you like, is the last layer. It is the last layer that goes on. And then it just sort of grows.
Now, is that... Is the hand stitching, the embroidery, is that an enhancement in your mind, an integral part of the art? Is it to add some texture? Or yes to all?
I would probably say yes to all. I want to think that my hand stitching is not, you don't look at it and think, oh, look, she's put hand stitching on it. It's a complete thing. It's an integral part of the piece itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So yes to all of the things you said. Because I think that hand stitching for me should be something that if you're looking at the piece from a distance, your eye is drawn and then you want to go closer to see what's going on.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, and that's when I look at your work, I don't see the embroidery as an add-on. In each case, it's an integral part of expressing the overall package.
Yes, and I know what I'm trying to achieve. And there have been times when I've put it on and I've stitched into something and then taken it off because I thought, no, it's not working. So it doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
But normally, once I start, I get going, and then I don't even have to think about it.
And that part just comes out of your head then?
Yes, and also I know when to stop, because it's almost like the piece talks to me and says, okay, I'm done now. That's it. You can stop. Yes, that's how it is for me. It sounds a bit strange, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. No, there was some quote that what your work begins from emotional response and evolves naturally. And, you know, if you're one and you're clearly one of those people where this is just in your head and it has to come out. So it, you know, it comes out through your hands. And I can see where everybody says, stop, you've done enough, leave it. And
at all. And for me, it has throughout my life, being able to create something has been a good way to get a lot of stuff out, which I haven't been able to get out any other way.
Okay.
And also it can turn something that might be quite tricky and difficult into something that I'm happy with. I mean, I did a series of work once about a situation that was going on in my life, and it was called Secrets and Lies. So that gives you a little bit of an insight. and I devised this code for Secrets and Lies. So every piece of work I made had this code on it about secrets and lies. And it was very cathartic, absolutely fantastic. And I have to say, at the end of it, I burnt the work. I thought, that's it, I'm done now, I feel cleansed of this. So I burnt the work, and I knew when I was making it that it was never going to be out there for sale, because I just didn't want to have to explain it. But I needed to do the work for me. So there have been a few of those moments. I haven't done that for a long time, actually. I know other people write letters and then burn them, but it's the same sort of thing for me. So,
yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, because, you know, you get that emotional out of you, and you didn't, you don't want anyone else to see it and you want to explain it to anyone because it's your personal
yes.
life. Just to burn it up. What? That's fabulous.
Yes. And I think there are lots of artists out there who don't feel the need to explain what, you know, the meaning behind the work. And I think sometimes it's nicer for the viewer to see what they want to see in it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than trying to explain it.
Yeah.
I have a quick question. Have you done anything with COVID? I mean, you're such an artist with all the emotions that go along with it. Have you done any piece
that has been related to COVID?
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, no, I haven't. I haven't felt the urge. I think I just don't want it in my studio. Life's difficult enough at the moment without. I can see that it would be a catalyst for quite a lot of people about COVID. And I think there's going to be a lot of work at the end of this about COVID. But for me, no, it hasn't motivated me at all. I got other things that motivate me. And not have you done some work related to COVID?
No, but I've been thinking about it. And that's why I'm asking, because I do have people I know who are working on things that have done things that have been very emotional. And,
yes.
And this is, at first it was just, it's just been bothersome, but now it's beginning to be more than just bothersome.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, I need to find a way to express it, and I just haven't found that yet. But the need is growing, is getting ever stronger to do
yes.
something.
Yeah.
To make something.
I think I've been thinking along the lines of, you know, we are never going to return to normal. I've been thinking about that a little bit, because, mm-hmm. you know, I think there's a lot of the world that's saying, oh, when things get back to normal, and I don't think they will.
No. It's brought about too many changes in
yes.
our societal ongoing activities that many of them will never go back.
No.
I mean, just the workplace alone has been upended, and you know, people going to a 9-to-5 job at an office, that whole structure has just been torn apart, and it's not going back.
No, because here in the UK, we've just had work from home if you can.
You know,
that's just come. And I consider myself very lucky that I've always, you know, had a studio, so I can work from home. But I think for some people, it must be a real challenge.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
So as we get a little more mobile, a little more free from this COVID thing, is teaching coming back to you? Teaching in person, or are you still virtual?
This year, I have to say I'm not a fan of online teaching. I don't know if you noticed, but I found it quite difficult. It's not my favorite thing.
Yeah.
I did it because they asked me to do it, but I wasn't terribly, I didn't feel relaxed or comfortable. I felt a little bit like the rabbit in the headlights. but this year I have resumed face-to-face teaching. So I did I taught at festival. Brunhilde couldn't come, so I asked another friend to come with me. So we taught at festival, and I did another workshop in somewhere in the UK, and slowly it's starting to resume. But I've got lots of face-to-face workshops that have just been cancelled and then rebooked and then cancelled, and I have one in February this is now the fifth time we've cancelled it. I prefer face-to-face. I prefer to be in the room with the person.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I've not pursued online teaching, because it just isn't for me. And when you contacted me, I was thinking, oh, no, you're not going to want to see me.
No.
We don't have to see you. No.
Because I just don't like, it's very strange. I don't mind being in a classroom setting, but this face to face over the internet, I find it really difficult. You know, I just feel quite wooden. I don't feel relaxed, and I admire anybody who does it because it is a skill, but it's not really for me.
Yeah,
it's not for me. No.
Yeah, it hits everybody at a different level. Yeah, no doubt.
Yes,
no doubt.
Yes. So next year I have a few workshops that are happening in Germany because I teach in Germany quite a lot, and that's not difficult for me because I can drive there.
Mm-hmm.
It's quicker to drive than it is to fly.
Yeah.
Which is really strange. So, and I have some in the UK. But teaching is not the biggest part of my artistic thing.
Yeah.
But I do like it, and it does give me a lot. It's very nice interacting with people. Like it very much.
Yes.
Yes, I like it very much.
But creating in your studio still wins.
Yes, absolutely it does. Yeah. Absolutely. And at the moment, I'm sitting in my studio, and what normally happens is if I'm in full swing, it ends up looking like somebody has burgled it because I'm so untidy. And tomorrow, I'm looking around and thinking, I am going to have to tidy up. Sometimes it gets so bad the window cleaner comes and he says you really should tidy up in there.
Oh my.
So but it's
love it.
But it's how I work. That's how I work.
Yep,
so
yeah.
You know, yep. We all work differently.
That's yep, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, Jude, it has been an absolute treat. Thanks for making time to do this. Really enjoyed it.
I have really enjoyed it too. And thank you very much for asking me. I've really enjoyed it.
Been a great time. All right. And thanks to everyone for listening.